All right, good afternoon to you all. What did I do? Let me stop where I am. I'm hearing that wheezing sound, which means I've moved too far somewhere. Let's see, so can I move over here again? Okay, I can move. Okay, great. All right. Can you guys hear me okay? All right, we're going to talk about something. When people hear this, they think I'm talking about sexual lust, and that's why it's a misnomer. And this whole idea is taking the concept of idols and expanding it more. You have heard for many years, idols of the heart, idols of the heart, idols of the heart, idols of the heart. As we really start to look at scripture more, we'll discover that it's not necessarily idols of the heart, but idolatrous lust. And the concept first came many years ago as I was at Masters University, which is not Masters University, Masters College. As I was working on my thesis to graduate, Dr. Stuart Scott was my advisor. And I said, I think I want to do something on idols of the heart. You know, I want to use that as my thesis. He says, no, don't do that. Why don't you do something on idolatrous lust? I said, idolatrous what? What is that? He said, I want you, in your thesis, I want you to research all of what the Bible says from the Old and New Testament by looking up the word lust from the Old and New Testament. And I want you to look at the Old and New Testament of all the places you see the word idol, and I want you to develop your thesis from that. And what I discovered, and this was years ago, that what we so nicely call idols of the heart, it's really more lust of the heart and idols of creation. And what we'll discover is this, is that the idol is the thing that I seek in order to satisfy the lustful desires of my heart. And as I was looking at the Old and New Testament, looking at everywhere you saw the word idol, you saw the word lust, I discovered that an idol, again, was something that people were bowing down to. They were trying to depend on. It wasn't the end. It was always a means to something else. And I discovered that with lust, there was always something that they had made more important than God and others. And it started as a passion of the soul that would move into a lifestyle. That's way beyond sex. And a lot of people, because they reduce the word lust to sex, they miss the deepness of the word goes beyond sex. It's any desire that I turn into a demand. It's anything I'm willing to sin to get and sin when I don't get. And then I turn to particular people, places, products, or perspectives, which are the idols, to satisfy the lust of my heart. And so what we get is the picture, idolatrous lust, not just idols of the heart. Now, this concept has been around for a while, but it hasn't yet picked up a lot of steam. It's starting to in different places. But as I train people in counseling, what I share with them is that the root of their issue beyond pride, once you get beyond pride, at the core, you will find it's always idolatrous lust. In other words, there are some desires that have become so important that they've made demands, and they're always looking to something outside of God and creation to bow down to give it to them. They're looking for a person. They're looking for a place. They're looking for a product. They're looking for a perspective. They're looking for something that can satisfy blank of their hearts. Hence the term idolatrous lust. Does everybody see where we're going here? And so if you look at the marriage, people will say, well, you know, you have idols of the heart with your wife. No. What it is a man may have a lustful desire for respect, and his wife is the idol that he uses to satisfy his lustful desire for respect. See, you can change the idol, but if you never deal with the lust, it's just a perpetual issue. So my goal today is to try to present to you this understanding of idolatrous lust by first showing you idolatry, then showing you lust, and then we put the terms together so you see how they fit together in a unique perspective. Now, I wrote a book on this, and it was basically my thesis from Masters. It's called With All Your Heart. And what I've done is I've articulated what I'm about to share with you in a lot of detail. The book is called With All Your Heart. Again, you can e-book it and have it in seconds, or you can order it from the website, our church, not our church website, but the Calson website. But the book is called With All Your Heart. And basically what I do is I spend a lot of time walking this out. And it was, again, the thesis, and I was challenged by Dr. Scott in evaluating this. And it changed my life. And so for me, when I'm counseling people, we go through all the details and all the other stuff. But at the end of the day, their root issue, beyond being self-centered, is consumed with something they've made more important than God, and using people and other things to try to get what they want. And so that's why they're angry. That's why they're worried. That's why they're depressed. That's why you sell the other stuff, because they're not dealing with the idolatrous lust. So given that perspective, I'd like you to turn in your notes to Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 13, or the first section, the characteristics of idolatry. Let's kind of look at that together. I want to ask someone, if you will be so kind as to read Jeremiah chapter 2, verse number 13. Jeremiah chapter 2, verse number 13. You got it? All right.
For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, to hew for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water.
Now, they've done two evils. One, they turned away from God, and two, they created idols. So let's break that down, as you see in your notes. Idolatry is depending on some aspect of life or creation, as you should depend on God, which in Jeremiah was categorized as broken cisterns. Broken cisterns are man-made, unreliable large pits dug in the rock, covered with plaster, used to gather rainwater. When cracks developed in the cisterns, they would hold no water, unlike the reliable natural springs of living water, which always provided water, no matter the situation, which was symbolizing God. Idolatry is dependent upon some aspect of life / creation at the level of worship above God to get what we treasure above God. Now, let that sink in for a moment. Idolatry is not the end. Idolatry is the means. Let that sink in. When you study the Old and New Testament, where there was an idol, the idol was to bring something else. It was bowed down to for what it can bring, not for what it is. It was not the means, or it was not the end, it was the means. Given that idolatry is dependence on certain aspects of life or creation at the level of worship above God, making them the avenue to our satisfaction and the what? Solution to our problems. That's an idol. It's not what you want. It brings you what you want. Consider the idol like the refrigerator. Boy, do we bow down to that refrigerator, right? But why is the value the refrigerator? What are we after? What's in the refrigerator? It's holding what we want. When it no longer holds what we want, what do? We stop going to that refrigerator and we go somewhere else because it's not holding what we want. An idol is like the refrigerator. It's not the end. It's the means. And if we can get it somewhere else, guess what? We'll stop going to that refrigerator because we can get it somewhere else. So if you understand what idolatry, what we're showing you as we look at it from that perspective, it's the thing we depend on. Letter D, idolatry is the preoccupation with some aspect of life or creation above and apart from the Creator to bring some longings of the hearts that we have become the lust of our hearts. I worship this thing because I worship something else. And I worship this thing to bring me the other thing that I worship. So idolatrous lust is all worship. It's just different sides of the same coin. Now, given that, let's take a look at the creation of idolatry. The creation of idolatry. Letter A, idols are created when we no longer look to God as the source of our satisfaction. So remember, in Jeremiah 2, what did they do? They forsook God and looked to something else to satisfy the thirst of their souls. But what were they trying to satisfy? The what? Thirst of their souls. It's not the thing itself, it's what the thing would bring them. That's the distinction between an idol and the lust. Idols are created when we no longer look to God as the solution to our problems. So when you think about an idol, you believe it's the source of your satisfaction. You believe it's the solution to your problems. That's an idol. So you depend on it for the solutions it can bring or the satisfaction it can bring. It is your little God for what it can provide to you that you treasure. When you no longer want blank, whatever blank is, you stop pursuing this particular idol. Letter C, when we no longer look to God as the source of our satisfaction, we look to his creation to bring it to us. When we no longer look to God as a solution to our problems, we look to his creation to bring it to us. So when we understand this, now we can really understand the concept of Ezekiel chapter 14. And again, I don't think you may have that in your notes, or you may not, but I want you to put it there if it's not there. Ezekiel 14, verse 3, when it says, these men come to me, but they have set up what? Idols in their what? Heart. Now we can understand that better, because think about what God is saying. These people are coming to me, but they've already put something up as their own solution, their own satisfaction to give them what they want. Now they come to me and they've got these things in place of me. Should I even talk to them? Should I even consult with them when they've got another God in place to satisfy other issues of their hearts? And even if they didn't have those gods in place, the real issue is they want something more than me. That's what a lustful desire is. I'm willing to sin to get it and sin when I don't get it. And I'm looking to something else, idolatry, some idol, to satisfy these things of my soul. So let's look at the criticism and consequences of idolatry. Here's what we see. It's a little different on my notes here, but it should be the same with you guys. Idolatry is evil in the what? Idolatry leads you away from serving God to serving his creation. Idolatry leads you to stumbling into further sin. Idolatry leads God to address you according to your sin of idolatry instead of the request you bring to him. Let me see if I can put it to you this way. You put something in front of God to satisfy things in your heart away from God. And then you expect him to bless you. And you expect him to listen to you in your prayers. God is saying, you must be out of your mind. And you are. You're being friendly with the world and hostile towards me. You're consumed with wanting what you want. And you want this thing to bring it to you. And then you want to have a little talk with me on the side. Does that make any sense to you? And we do it all the time. Now, given that, I want you to see these categories of idolatry and what it looks like so that you can begin to think about it. Remember, idolatry is the dependence on certain aspects of life or creation at the level of worship above God, making them the avenue. Please underline that word so we can make a distinction between idols and lust, making them the avenue to our satisfaction and solutions to our problems. Idolatry is the preoccupation with some aspect of life or creation above and apart from the Creator to bring some longing or longings of our hearts that have become the lust of our hearts. So I keep trying to repeat it in different ways so you can get the distinction. The idol is the means, the thing that I depend on is the source to my satisfaction, the solution to my problems. It is not the end. I'm looking for it to bring me something. Let me give you some examples of idols. Depending on people as the source to our satisfaction and the solution to our problems, above and apart from God, to bring some longing or longings of our hearts that have become the lust or lust of our hearts, making the lust the source of our satisfaction and the end of our problems. Depending on places as the source to our satisfaction and the solution to our problems, above and apart from God, to bring some longing of our hearts that have become the lust of our hearts, making the lust the source of our satisfaction and the end of our problems. Depending on products as the source to our satisfaction and the solution to our problems. Let me keep going. Depending on perspectives as the source to our satisfaction and the solution to our problems. Depending on positions as the source of our satisfaction and the solution to our problems. Are you starting to get a picture here of what an idol looks like? Depending on power as the source of our satisfaction and the solution to our problems. Depending on platforms of influence as a source to our satisfaction and a solution to our problems. Depending on politics as the source of our satisfaction and solution to our problems. Depending on money as the source of our satisfaction and solution to our problems. Depending on medication as a source of our satisfaction and solution to our problems. Depending on the media as the source of our satisfaction and solution to our problems. And sadly to say, depending on ministry. Ladies and gentlemen, these are examples of idols. They're not the end. They're not what you're looking for. They are what you lean on, as you should lean on God, in order to bring you something else. And from the Old Testament to the New Testament, the Bible unfolds this reality that an idol is a thing, in a sense of something you construct or something you hold on to as a way to give you something else. Let me suggest to you the pattern of how this works. It starts with the dilemma. We no longer accept and embrace God as the source of our satisfaction and the solution to our problems. That's the dilemma. Then it moves to the downfall. We turn from God and turn to His creation as the source to our satisfaction and the solution to our problems. Then we move in a direction. When God is no longer the source of our satisfaction and the solution to our problems, we make man and creation big and God small, resulting in a lack of fellowship with God, leading to deeper sin in our lives. And then the discipline. We can expect God to address our sin of idolatry as He sees fit, while not addressing our prayer requests as we desire. If we keep resisting God's discipline, we fall further away from God, resulting in further negative consequences to experience as a result. You see the cycle of idolatry? You see the dilemma, the downfall, the direction, and then the discipline. Now, before we go any further, I want to give you about 2 or 3 minutes to review, understand this definition of idolatry and the process. And then we're going to transition to talk about lust, what lust is. And then we're going to begin to move all of this together to understand our premise of idolatrous lust. Okay? So take about 2 or 3 minutes, do a quick review with someone at your table. Define idolatry. Define it. Articulate it. Explain it. Take about 2 or 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Okay, everybody. What I hope we can do now, you've got a picture of idolatry, and I challenge you to do what I had to do for my research. Go through all the Old Testament and New Testament passages and just look at it within the context in which they were described. And you'll begin to see how I was able to come to these conclusions by just looking at the context of each of those passages dealing with idolatry. And you'll begin to see it was a means and never the end. It is something that I'm using for something else. Now, the flip side of the coin, we want to talk about lust, which is the end. This is the thing that I'm after. This is the thing that I'm living for. This is the thing that I'm willing to die for. This is the thing I'm willing to sin to have and sin when I don't have. This is the problem. Not that idolatry is not a problem, but idolatry is only as powerful as the lust of my hearts. You change the lust of my hearts, idols no longer are idols, nor do they have any influence on my life. See if I can put it to you this way. Who has the power, the drug addict or the drug dealer? Think about it. Who has the power, the drug addict or the drug dealer? The addict. See, the drug dealer only has power because you want what he's selling. When you no longer want what he's selling, you can walk by the drug dealer without a problem because your heart no longer longs for whatever he has to offer. So it's always the lust of the heart that drives you, not the idol that can give it to you. You change the lust of the heart, idols really have no power because they only function because of what you want from them. That's why when I tell people about manipulation, you're only manipulated by this person because of the lustful hearts of your desire and connection to this person. This person is an idol in your life. When they no longer stop being an idol, it won't make a difference because you idolize somebody else. When you stop longing and living for approval and start worshiping God and not worrying about what people think of you and focus on loving them, no one will have the power to manipulate you because you're willing to suffer for righteousness' sake. Because you're not consumed with what they think of you, you're concerned about what you can do for them. There is no fear in love. Perfect love cast out what?
Fear.
Fear of man is idolatry. I've put you in the wrong place in my life, so the power you have is the power I gave because of what I want from you, or I'm scared I think you can take from me. Am I making sense to you? So idolatry is only as powerful as the lustful desires of your heart. So we need to understand what this lust is so that we can begin to move forward and make these connections. So we got to spend time now dissecting the concept of lust from the Old and New Testament. So what I want to do is to highlight some key passages to kind of unfold it. I want to ask someone to start reading for us James chapter 1, verse 13 to verse 14. And then if someone will be so kind as to read Ezekiel 33 to 31, and then someone to read James chapter 4, verse 1 to verse 4. But let's start with James chapter 1, verse 13 to 14, and we're going to break some things down. Who would? Thank you, sir. You have that for us.
James 1:13-14. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted, neither tempted he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust.
Every man is drawn away by his what?
Own lust.
So guess how you're tempted? Not by idols, but you're tempted by your own what? The idol is a means to get to you because of the lustful desires of your heart. See, Satan knows exactly what you like. Satan knows exactly where you're willing to sin to get what you want and sin when you don't get what you want. And temptation only works because you have lustful desires of the heart. If you have lustful desires of the heart, you wouldn't be tempted. So once you get a hold of the lustful desires, you'll discover that a lot of temptations will always rise to the top, not because God is doing something mean to you, but because you are consumed with something mean. Something good has now become worship. So when we talk about a lustful desire, part number five, let's take a look at this together. The characteristics of the lust of our hearts. Lust of the hearts are longings that have become constant cravings of our hearts in a evil or wrong way. These are things that in and of themselves may not be wrong, but you've made them wrong because you're willing to sin to have them and sin when you don't have them. They have become a preoccupation of your soul above loving God and above loving others. Lust of the hearts are longings that have moved from something we want to something we must have, making something that once was a good thing now an evil thing, making it a sin of our lives because we are consumed with it above God and his will. Lust of the hearts are longings that have become such a preoccupation of our hearts that we're easily enticed by the devil when it comes to them because they have become inordinate, sinful affections of our soul. Lust of the hearts are longings that have become such a preoccupation of our hearts that we're willing to sin to obtain them, sin to keep them, and sin when we do not receive them, or sin when we lose them, making those longings a worship in our lives above worship and obedience to God. Now, before we go any further, a husband and wife comes to me for counseling. You know what the primary issue is. They're so self-centered that they've turned the other person into an idol to satisfy their lustful desires. And when you make a person an idol can't fail you because you're too dependent on them to satisfy the lustful desires of your heart. And so therefore, that person can never get grace from you. They always get criticism. And you always want to control them because they are the determination of your satisfaction and solutions. So you're not really caring about them. You're consumed with them because they can make or break the things that you worship as it relates to lust. But we say we're having marital problems, character deficiencies. And part of those character deficiencies is a mindset on self, preoccupation with what I want from you that's become a demand and a lust, and I hold you hostage as the idol to satisfy my desires. No wonder we have such struggles in marriage, because we're worshiping the wrong God and consumed with the wrong things. Am I making sense to you so far? Did we finish A, B, C, and D? Because sometimes I get distracted in my own rumbling. We finished that?
Yes.
All right, let's look at, this is my favorite verse of the Old Testament to understand lust. Someone read for us Ezekiel chapter 33, verse 31. The commitment to lust of our heart. I want you to see this. This is amazing. This is anybiblechurch.com or any Bible church in America. This is every parishioner that we see on any Sunday morning. Okay? Someone read that for us. Ezekiel chapter 33, verse 31.
And they come to you as people come, and they sit before you as my people, and they hear what you say, but they will not do it. For with lustful talk in their mouths they act. Their heart is set on their gain.
Wow. They love to hear your preaching, Pastor, but they're not going to do any of it. Oh, but they love to come and hear it, but they're consumed with the lustful desires of their heart. And that's what they want to talk about. That's what they want to live for. But they don't mind coming every Sunday because they love to hear the good word of God. is they leave away with the lustful desires of their hearts. Does that make sense to you? Isn't that anybiblechurch.com right now? Pastor, I hear what you're saying, but why do I keep doing what I'm doing? Because of the idolatrous lust of your life. You're consumed with this person, place, product, or perspective satisfying these particular longings of your heart that have become the lustful desires of your heart. And you hear what I'm saying, but you're consumed with these things. And it's not until you repent of this will you stay stuck where you are. So let's take a look at this. When we are committed to the lust of our hearts, we will still listen to truth and delight in the truth or hear, but we will not obey the truth because we are preoccupied with the lust of our hearts. When we're committed to the lust of our hearts, they become a constant topic of discussion. When we're committed to the lust of our hearts, we are in constant pursuit of obtaining them. When we're committed to the lust of our hearts, we do not find obedience to God something to be treasured above the lust we have treasured in our hearts. So when you start to see the distinction, notice the distinction between idols and lust. That idol was the thing we looked to as the source of our satisfaction, the solution to our problems. The lust is the thing that we're after. The lust is the thing that we hold to. The lust is what we want. That's what we crave. And we're looking to this idol to satisfy these lusts. The power is not so much in the idol. Where's the power? In the lust. The idol's power will die when you stop lusting for what you want from the idol. Until then, the only power it has is because of the lustful desires of your soul connected to it. So, given that, let's talk about this idea of this cancer of the lust of our hearts. And I want you to see what it does. Someone read for us James chapter 4, verse 1 to verse 4. This cancer of the lust of our hearts.
What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that may war in your members? No lust and do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it.
Now, I want you to let that sink in. Conflict that happens in all your relationships is because of the lustful desires in your heart. And you're fighting with your husband, your wife, your family, your friends, because there's something you treasure that either you think they're about to take away from you or not give to you. And because that's more important to you than loving them, conflict arises. And we keep trying to resolve conflict at the surface level. When there's conflict between you and others, it's a lustful desire issue. What do you want that you're not getting? What are you getting you don't want? And what have you made more important in your heart that you're willing to fight for and to fight to keep? That's why you fight your husband, your wife, and anybody else. And if you keep trying to come with, well, let's figure out a win-win situation. What we're trying to figure out is a lust situation. Versus saying, what led you to be willing to sin against me and for me to sin against you that we want so desperately? The lust of our hearts. So given that, let's take a look at this together. The lust of our hearts can lead us to kill others or at least be envious of others. The lust of our hearts can lead us to create conflict with others. The lust of our hearts can lead us to pray selfishly. The lust of our hearts can lead us to be friends with the world system, resulting in acting as enemies of God. So what are the consequences of our lust of our hearts? The lust of our hearts can lead us to walking in further sin in our thoughts, words, and actions. Walking in further sin in our thoughts, words, and actions reveals that one is walking in the flesh, which leads to corruption in one's life, which ultimately leads to death. This could be physical death, where as a result of a Christian's unrepentant sin, one is now disciplined by God and being taken from earth to be with him, resulting in loss of rewards for eternity as a result of constant disobedience on earth. This could be eternal death, where as a result of an unbeliever's life of sin, he now faces the consequences of rejecting God and living a life of sin, which is burning in hell forever. This lustful thing is serious. Would you agree? Now, as we gave you examples of what idolatry looks like, let's take a look at some of the examples of the lust of our hearts. And again, this is not comprehensive. These are just to name a few. Again, the categories of the lust of our hearts. Remember, lust of our hearts are desires we believe we cannot do without being satisfied. We're willing to sin to obtain them, sin to keep them, sin when we do not receive them, or sin when we lose them, making those longings a worship in our lives above worship and obedience to God. Here's some examples of what they can be. To be loved by others, that has become a demand or craving we believe we can't live without. To be accepted by others, that has become a demand or craving we believe we can't live without. To be understood by others, that has become a demand or craving we believe we can't live without. Now we'll keep going from there. To never be disappointed or hurt. To be respected by others. To be served by others. To have personal preferences accommodated at all times. To be viewed as competent by others. To be approved of by others. To belong to someone. To be held in high regard by others. To be significant to others, to be satisfied by others, to maintain a favorable position with others, to be secure and safe with others, to never be alone, to have someone exposed for the way they have mistreated us, to have someone suffer the consequences for the way they for what they did to us. Now, given that, and those are just a few, when those things are in your heart, you're willing to sin to get them and sin when you don't get them and sin to keep them. But let me show you how this lustful process works as you see the model behind you. There's a dialogue of the world. Satan uses the world to speak to the desires of our hearts that have become the lust of our hearts. Then there's a deliberation of our hearts as the world speaks to our hearts, appealing to the lust of our hearts while presenting the various delights in the world that will lead us into sin to obtain or maintain the lust of our hearts. Our minds contemplate pursuing or resisting these worldly delights. The direction of our lives. If we do not resist the temptation to find our delight in the world instead of in Jesus Christ, we will live by earthly, natural, demonic wisdom, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. The display of disobedience. If we do not resist the temptation to find our delight in this world instead of in Jesus Christ, we will walk in a lack of love for God and a lack of love for others, revealing a life that is consumed with the lust of our hearts. And the cycle keeps going. Now, I want you to take about 3 or 4 minutes and notice the distinction between idolatry and lust. Look at the cycle of idolatry. Look at the cycle of lust. And see how they are working. And then we're going to, in a few minutes, bring these two together to help you now understand idolatrous lust. So take a few moments, do a quick review of lust. Make sure you understand it. Go back to idolatry. Look at how they work together and how they are different but work together. Take about 3 or 4 minutes. Talk with each other.
There is no one.
Okay, everybody. Now that we have evaluated idolatry and tried to get a good look at idolatry, we've evaluated lust. Now we can understand the term idolatrous lust. And so let's look at the term and see now the definition of the term. As we've looked at both aspects, we've looked at idolatry, we looked at lust. Now here's idolatrous lust. Something you bow down to that you believe will bring you what you truly treasure. That's idolatry. While making what you truly treasure something you bow down to in place of the living God. That's lust. It is the various aspects of life and creation we worship above the Creator, as well as the basic ways we worship the creation above the Creator. You get it? So now, idolatrous lust. I bow down to something in order to bring me something that I bow down to. It's all worship, but we're talking about it at different avenues. One avenue of worship is the idolatry. The other avenue of worship is the lust. And none of it is worshiping God. It's a worship of self and the worship of creation. So if we pull this together, the avenues we pursue and bow down to in the form of worship, idols, along with these treasures we bow down to in the form of worship, lust, make up the idolatrous lust in our lives. For example, here's how it works. Bowing down to people, idol, as we should God to receive the acceptance we treasure and crave in an inordinate way, lust, in place of loving God and loving others, is what? Idolatrous lust. You see how it works? Which thing is the idol in this situation? And what's the lust in this situation? You see how that works? So when I'm counseling someone, I'm making a distinction between the idol and the lust. And if we remove the idol, it's still not going to help them. Why? Because we haven't dealt with the lust. So, okay, this person is out of their life, but they still have the lust of their hearts. They'll just find another idol to satisfy their what? Lust. That's why you have to go there and make distinctions, but go into that a little further in your process of evaluation and counsel. Here's another example. Bowing down to education, as we should God, in order to be viewed as competent, which we treasure and crave in an inordinate way, lust, in place of loving God and loving others, is idolatrous lust. What's the idol? What's the lust? And man, how many degrees do we pursue so that people can think we're smart? Versus pursuing them to be further along, to be useful as a servant to God. See, the problem is not the degree, it's what was the lustful desire of the heart if there were ones, if there is one. See, again, all of these issues, when you start to look at it through this lens, it helps you to begin to see what some of the core issues are to get to the heart of it quicker. Here's another example. Bowing down to money as we should God to receive the comfort we treasure and crave in an inordinate way in place of loving God and loving others. What's the idol? What's the lust? So that makes idolatrous lust. Here's a final example. Bowing down to control as we should God to receive the security we treasure and crave in an inordinate way in place of loving God and loving others is idolatrous lust. What's the idol?
Control.
And what's the lust?
Security.
Ah, when people talk about you are a control freak. No, that's idolatry. What are they lusting after that they believe they have to be in control all the time? Ah, and for some people, it could be approval or acceptance. Hence, perfectionism is their idol, where approval and acceptance is their lust. See, when you start to break it down that way, you go, ah, this is why this person is striving so hard. This is the idol of their life. This is the lust of their heart. Now I see what's going on, and we need to figure out how to help them resolve this matter. Now, no one wakes up in the morning and says, you know what? I'm going to have idolatrous lust today. That's a great idea. Yeah. There's a way in which you lead into that. And I want to show you how it happens. And this is where when people aren't paying attention to their lives, they find themselves moving in this area. So let's look at it. Number one, the mindset. Your mind is set on things below instead of things above. Motivation. You begin to make self-interest a priority above God's will. Meditation. Your desires become preoccupations, resulting in becoming lust. Number four, methods. You look for avenues to satisfy your desires, which have now become lust. Manner. You bow down and submit to these avenues in order to obtain what you have turned into lust, thus making these avenues idols you bow down to in order to get what you lust after. And then you are mastered. You become a servant of your flesh. Ladies and gentlemen, does this make sense to you? We are expanding the concept of idolatry to hopefully help you see idolatrous lust so that you can begin to even go further with people that you are working with to show them how in-depth this is. And by the way, this all starts with pride. As you are self-centered, this will lead you to idolatrous lust. So that means the more you walk in humility, the less you walk in idolatrous lust. So how do we repent of idolatrous lust? Number one, identify desires or cravings that have preoccupied your minds to the point of lust. Number two, identify the avenues you've pursued and thus have bowed down to in place of God to obtain these desires or cravings that have preoccupied your minds to the point of lust. Letter C, identify the sinful thoughts, attitudes, and behaviors that have come about as a result of these desires or cravings that have preoccupied your minds to the point of lust. Letter D, confess the lust, the idols, the sinful thoughts, sinful attitudes, and sinful behaviors you have identified to God and others accordingly. Letter E, replace your lust, idols, sinful thoughts, sinful attitudes, sinful behaviors you have identified with genuine worship of God, godly thoughts, godly attitudes, godly behaviors. Decide to make God priority over all and everything. And then lastly, do what? Does that sound like realization, remorse, renounce, repent? Does anyone remember those things? Different ways of saying some of the same things to you. Now, let me give you something that I do with people to help them to begin to see and understand this. And you should have it in your notes. I give them this as a journal to do at the end of the day. So I ask them for a week or two to basically use these questions and write out the answers. And I tell them, don't do this in the morning. You haven't sinned good enough yet in the morning. Okay. You're just getting up. So wait to the end of the day, you know, after you've done everything, and then fill this out. So maybe not before you go to bed because you're a little sleepy, but a little bit before then, maybe before dinner or after dinner. Fill this out. And I want you to look at some of these questions that are being asked of this person that we want to come back with every week to begin to explore, to help them see the in-depthness of the idolatrous lust. What did you want today? Or what were you expecting to happen today? Who did you want it from or expect it to come from? What desire or desires would this fulfill in your life? How much of your time was spent thinking, speaking, and acting on what you wanted? What ways did you sin in thoughts, words, or actions to get what you wanted? What ways were your attitudes and actions like? What were your attitudes and actions like towards God and others as a result of not getting what you wanted? Did I skip any? Am I on point with you guys? Did I go? Oh, I'm sorry. What ways did you sin in thoughts, words, or actions when you did not get what you wanted? What person or persons did you sin against to get what you wanted? What person or persons did you sin against because you did not get what you wanted? What were your attitudes and actions like towards God and others as a result of getting what you wanted today? What were your attitudes and actions like towards God and others as a result of not getting what you wanted today? What biblical standards or principles could you use to explain your thoughts, words, and actions today? What biblical standards or principles should you have practiced in thoughts, words, or actions today? Were your thoughts, words, and actions towards others based primarily on how you felt or what God commanded? Explain. Now imagine if you did that for the next 14 days on a daily basis. What do you think God would expose to you in the midst of this? Your idols and your lust, hence the idolatrous lust of your lives. Now, we've got about 6 minutes, so I'm going to open the floor for you for any questions or comments you may have, and we can try to dialogue about this particular concept. So, questions or comments you may have as it relates to this concept of idolatrous lust. How clear is it? Very clear. Okay, just want to make sure. Yes, sir.
All right, so you stress that the idol will not disappear until you address the lust. And what's behind the lust, of course, is sin. So what feeds into that lust? Is it experience? Is it hurt? Is it upbringing? I mean, those big lusts.
Lust are just natural desires you've turned into things that you value above love for God and others. And a desire can be anything, and it can be influenced by anything, or just be something that you just decide you want. You know, no child grows out of the womb wanting Nike tennis shoes. Okay? That is something they learn to value, not something they have as instinct. You know, so it can be anything that you treasure. It's not necessarily born out of anything other than you like something and it's become now a demand that you must have versus something you can do without. Yes, sir.
Counseling a couple now where the marriage is falling apart. The husband has been he's been entertaining another relationship on the side. The wife acknowledges his behavior is sinful, but has these panic attacks anchored in her approval of him over her approval of God. She's got such a strong desire to say things and do things to try to wake him up. And now she just was diagnosed with cancer, and he said, "You've always found a way to get into the center of attention." And even above all these hurtful, hateful things he says, she still wants to try to find some way to wake him up. And we're trying to get her to this point where his approval of her and his attention to her has taken precedence over her anchoring her relationship in God. And we're kind of at an impasse where we've gone through this and she sees it, but our heart's breaking because she's not moving beyond that.
Until God breaks her, there's nothing you can do. You stay faithful to showing her, but you can't make anybody see. But what that shows you is how deep her demand is for approval and how resentful she is in her heart, which is why the panic attacks exist. That is a byproduct of a guilty conscience and the fear of judgment of the soul that's now producing this anxiety because of these other sinful issues she's not addressing. And so even though she is suffering because of her husband, she's also in sin in connection with her husband. Don't allow the suffering aspect to get you to override the sin aspect with her, because her lustful desire for approval is what's keeping her in bondage, not the sinfulness of her husband. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's hard to add infidelity and cancer to now you're yes. A sinner in the midst of it.
What you want to do is do the balance. You know, everybody suffers and everybody sins.
Yeah.
So as you deal with her suffering, you want to come around to, as you're suffering through this matter, I think you will find peace in the midst of the suffering if you're willing to deal with the sin that you're not willing to let go of. So you always bring it back around, but you don't negate one or the other. You have to be masterful to work between both. Or you override the sin because of the suffering, or you magnify the sin and overlook the suffering. You have to do both, and it takes time. And you may think it's mean, but it's not mean, because what do we do at the same time? We suffer and we sin. So what do we need at the same time? Rebuke and support at the same time. Okay. All right. Anybody? Yes, ma'am. Yes.
Because the dilemma is we no longer accept God and embrace God as the source of our satisfaction, right? So that's under the idolatry. And you said that's a means. The lust is what started first.
Because I have a lustful desire of my heart,
okay,
I'm no longer dealing with God. And because of this lustful desire of my heart, I'm looking for something else other than God to satisfy it. Because of the lustful desires of our heart that we have now. Yes. Yes. So you have desires of your heart that have become lustful, and that's why you're tempted. And since we're not sinless yet, we're just sinning less, those things still exist. And Satan is able to maneuver that, which is why idolatry is so satisfying or so interesting to us, because it feeds on the things of our heart that we treasure. And so all the world is doing is providing a means for us to satisfy these things of our heart that we've not yet surrendered over to God. Does that make sense?
It's getting there.
Let me put it to you simple. I'll make it simple. We are needy and greedy instead of content.
Wait, we are needy and greedy.
We are needy and greedy. Okay. And when you're needy or greedy, you're easily manipulated, because being needy or greedy is where you're lusting. And because you're needy and greedy, I can sell you anything and you'll buy it, even if it compromises your quote-unquote relationship with God. That's idolatrous lust. Okay. Yes, sir.
My question is on the level of practicality in the counseling. You've given us a great paradigm here that simplifies a very complex stuff. But I'm just looking at, you know, if I'm sitting down with some people not too biblically literate, how do you bring this in? How do you flesh this out in the counseling dynamic? Like, you take three sessions to walk through this. Do you start out with definitions? Is it homework?
You need to come to Houston and take my course. You're asking for a 30-second that takes 14 weeks, but let me give you the simplicity of it. Three words, okay? Awareness, acknowledgement, then action. Biblical counseling is in those three steps. I need to bring you to awareness through helping you to get an interpretation of your situation. So the first step is not to try to solve your problem. The first step is to give you a understanding of your problem from a biblical perspective. That's awareness. The second step, once you gain the awareness, is to lead you to acknowledgement and hopefully brokenness in the process of how you are within this interpretation that I've given you. That's step two. Then step three is to lead you to action of the put off and put on. So in every counseling case, I don't walk in first step trying to give them solutions on what to do. I want them to have an interpretation that's biblical of their situation. And that may take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sessions, as long as it takes for them to get the awareness. Then from there, I need you to see the mirror. Now that I've defined this, look at you in the midst of this and own up to it. That could take 4, 5, 6, 7, doesn't matter, as long as that happens. Now that you're broken and you are acknowledging, now let's get to work. So, 14 weeks, hopefully in 30 seconds. Is that online? I did a thing called Every Christian a Counselor, so it's you can find that online, and some of that information is there. All right, guys, my time is up. Thank you. God bless you.